Artichoke. It's 1991, and Julie, Radha, and I are standing in the two-story living room of a large, light-filled apartment on the Upper West Side of Manhattan. Also in attendance are two intently focused dachshunds who seem to be taking DNA samples from our shoes as we stare down at an antique ceramic tea set made by our grandfather's pottery around 1915. We are hoping to use it as inspiration for a lamp base we want to produce using the same clay and glaze formulas that we'd recently inherited and turned into an art tile business. The apartment, the tea set, and the dogs are owned by Jed and Alan, a designer-slash-architect team and the kind of couple you'd want to spend a weekend with in the Hamptons, antiquing in bridge and driving around in a sporty ice blue convertible with the dachshunds bookending you in the back seat, ears airborne at right angles. But our actual relationship is practical rather than social, as Jed and Alan had helped us launch our tile company and are now about to design this very lamp. The teapot is a dark stone-like matte green, understated petals etched in bas-relief against a flared base, the sides delineated by yellowish tones caused by rutile in the glaze breaking over the edges. Its profile is close to what we want for the lamp, like an artichoke, not the full round thistle blossom fruit you boil whole, but more like one that's been hungrily stripped down to just the shiny embryonic remains, bell-like and naked, a few petals clinging to the bottom. On the celery-colored wall above us, a large silk screen of Andy Warhol's Mao is watching it all go down. He is grandly displayed in pleasing colors, ironically and tastefully hung. How do you like them small-batch boutique artisanal apples, comrade? It occurs to me that the chairman might have an affectionate note attached to himself somewhere from Andy to Jed, our soft-spoken, smooth-faced designer, and Warhol's protege and lover from back in the factory days. I am contemplating this with one ear cocked to the conversation in the room and the other, of course, to the dachshunds, having been raised by one myself, a black and tan long hair named Feathers. He'd been given to me when I was 8 years old by Coogie, the chief designer for the old Fulper Pottery and dear family friend. My mind wanders back to the many times I would hand off some of our mother's more repulsive dinner creations to the dog, ever hopeful under the table. Calves' liver without the already devoured by me bacon, meatless Friday tuna surprise, and sometimes an artichoke leaf, because it was just so funny to watch Feathers snap it up, instantly spit it out in disgust, then shift from one paw to the other, begging for more. On the occasional nights we had artichokes, my mother, cheeks flushed from standing over a double boiler, fogged up bifocals giving her the look of one of those seemingly benign Alfred Hitchcock matrons, slowly turning a sinister face into the camera while ladling thick yellow hollandaise into Pyrex ramekins, placing each one next to a steaming, baseball-sized artichoke. They were then presented to us on separate plates, not because they are the Buddha-like divas of the vegetable kingdom, which they are, but because eating them makes a big mess. You peel, dip, then scrape against the lower teeth to suck out the fruit. The desiccated leaves are then abandoned haphazardly in pursuit of the tasty heart, which is the goal of the whole endeavor. The fluorescent light of the kitchen reveals an unsightly landscape of tooth-marked leaves and furry spikes the color of dried silver polish, simulating a miniature bombed-out rainforest at high noon, which remains remarkably intact upon landing in the garbage. My sister Radha, however, has implemented a different system. She stacks the leaves in equidistant petal piles, circling the core, not unlike a child on medicinal amphetamines. The heart is then surgically removed, she did claim to have been a doctor in a former life, and the nasty choke fibers tucked away discreetly under the future lamp design. Eventually, a dainty pattern emerges, recalling a rhododendron bloom amidst its leaves. It pleases her to use her fingers in this balletic way, showing off her elegant hands and perfect nails while organizing and consuming her food. I think of her clothes closet, similarly meticulous, everything arranged by category, dressy, casual, sporty, then by subsets of color, solids and patterns, newly dry-cleaned items in plastic bags at the ready, shoes lined up, jewelry gleaming in a tiered velveted box. This catalog-like attention to detail and tidiness seems to belie that part of her who, as my father griped, was hell-bent on going up the street when you point her down, who loved embroidering her image as the rebel daughter, and who left the party early if she showed up at all. Amid all this chaos-making stands evidence of other forces at work. The warrior artichoke and its arsenal of thorny leaves, stockpiled with military precision, guarding a tender, nourishing heart. They say the first step to successful rebellion is to organize, but I suspect even Mao would have failed to marshal our little army of Republican-raised Sunday Catholic girls who embraced consumerism with a fervor that would have made John Wanamaker proud. Maybe Radha just liked orderliness and the modicum of control it gave. Her artichoke technique had looked so simple to me, but I never managed to master it, becoming impatient and reckless, the hoped-for flower sadly lopsided as I lose interest and move on to dessert. Bringing a forkful of Sara Lee all-butter pound cake to my mouth, I see close up my gnawed-on nails with their broken, scabby cuticles and think, maybe that's the problem. I have nice enough hands, the fingers long and slender, but they are shaky, reflecting my generally nervous nature. Next to Radha's, mine look like the winter hands of an Irish washerwoman with the DTs. I can still hear the efficient rasp of the emery board as she strives toward smoothness and the desired oval shape, drinking packets of Knox gelatin known for its nail-strengthening qualities, which looks disgusting, but I guess works. Freakishly long nails were once considered a sign of aristocratic luxury where no manual labor need ever be involved, like those empress dowagers cushioned in silk, their foot-long fingernails draped over the armrest, dreaming up fun curtains for imperial carriages. "Hey, slave girl, don't you wish you were a rich kid?" Radha would call from the chaise lounge, raising her iced tea glass to smile benevolently at Julie or Aggie, who'd been recruited for some grunt gardening job that she'd managed to get out of. "Do I see Mao frowning?" "What?" I ask, suddenly brought back to the conversation in the apartment. "I'm sorry, what?" "Have you ever been to Queechee?" Alan is talking about his recent trip to Vermont to meet with the potter and glassmaker Simon Pierce. I only know of this place because of Queechee Gorge, a state park not far from Dartmouth College, where I'd once had a couple of preppy, hippie, wannabe boyfriends in the 70s. Neither one had worked out, so I was a bit sour on Queechee. The talk quickly returns to the design for the lamp, and plans are made for scale drawings to be ready for the next time we meet, colors discussed, and a deadline set. Mao is content again. The artichoke lamp is eventually made and marketed, and it is superb, with a double light bulb fixture illuminating the glaze like a little one-man showcase, and we get good press, ending up in New York Magazine's Best Bets and Martha Stewart Living. But profit is elusive. Handcrafted in the USA sounds good, but our production costs are way too high, and we regularly resist suggestions to manufacture overseas. Can you imagine? Our New Jersey grandfather would kick the sod blankets off his grave and come looking for us. One of the oldest American potteries, made in China? Good Christ! Mao is still smiling, but His jaw muscles twitch slightly. Standing around together on that bright afternoon, we could not know that Jed would suddenly be gone only 2 years later in a plane crash, and Radha, 15 years after that, taken slowly by a fast illness. The still-living Radha bends down to stroke the side of the teapot, enjoying the smoothness of the glaze, and I notice her hands remain graceful, having aged only slightly. The one flaw is a noticeable scar from when she was in her late teens and had her thumb practically sliced off, reaching forward to keep the nose of a small speedboat from ramming into the dock and instead getting her hand crushed. She and Aggie had taken Bay Bottom out by themselves one summer against our father's strict orders not to. It was a miracle she didn't lose the thumb, almost completely severed from the hand, dangling.
"I guess your hitchhiking days are over, Radha baby," my Uncle Vince had joked later.
Radha was the only one laughing. She wouldn't be caught dead hitchhiking. Back out on the sidewalk in front of Jed and Alan's building, final goodbyes are made. Then she languidly lifts that same hand, now gloved against the chill and buttery chocolate leather.
"Taxi!"